welcome to the Dr. Drew Podcast. We appreciate you being here. Oh, man, I am so – well, I've got a couple of great guests today. First of all, I'm very excited about that. But secondly, really excited about what's been going on, excuse me, at the drdrew.com website. Got a ton of stuff there. Please do check that out. New show, Dr. Drew After Dark. We're doing with Tom Segura and Christina P. Got the transgender series with some great commentary from Billy from Vanderpump Rules. We have the Opium series, which is now coming out as an audiobook with tremendous interviews with critical players and experts that are specific to each chapter in that series. So do check that out. I'm going to have a urologist in here named Ashley Winter in a minute, but right now I'm welcoming Alejandro Alva. He is the Chief Medical Officer of Pacific Neuropsychiatric Services. It's a specialty medical group that focuses on psychiatric and dual diagnosis conditions. He's also the medical director at True Recovery. Dr. Alva, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Drew. It's good talking to you.
So, you know, I thank you for the good work at True Recovery. Dr. Alva works there as an addiction psychiatrist. It's a program in Newport Beach, and he and I have discussed their program. I've sent people to the program. I've been happy with the work there. You can find out more at truerecovery.com, or you can follow him on Twitter at @true_recovery. It's T-R-U-E, recovery. And, yeah, there's generally good recovery in Newport. You know, I don't find a lot of it in other parts of Southern California, but there's a lot of good and good different levels of care and a lot of attention to things that – other parts of the recovery community don't focus on things like vocational rehab and how to live a sober life.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, it's been an interesting shift. And as you know, because you've been in this business for a long time, recovery has come a long way. And, you know, we saw a significant shift from the Florida folks, where if you wanted recovery in the last number of years, I mean, you had to fly to Florida to be able to get it. I mean, there were a number of facilities here in Orange County that have been around for a long time, but we saw a shift in the sense that the delivery of care had to change. And that's what we're attempting to do, and quite successful at that, I may add. You know, and the idea is to do an integrated approach to recovery as opposed to a kind of cookie-cutter approach where everybody gets the same thing, same meeting, same everything.
Yeah.
You know, what we're trying to do at this point in time is just kind of figure out what is the level of care that a particular individual needs, and then, you know, fill in the blanks.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say that we've now have different kinds of treatment options that have shown utility in addiction recovery and the dual diagnosis issues that now we're managing a little more aggressively up front. But things like DBT and CBT and vocational rehab, these are things that now are essential to proper treatment, yes?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, think about the fact that in the past it was, okay, here you go. You have an intervention, you know, famous show, by the way. And then after that, you went into a detox a treatment type of scenario. And then after that, you do 12 steps. And then, you know what, 30 days, you're done. You're out of here.
Yeah.
And the unfortunate reality is that the relapse rates were humongous.
Yeah.
You know, even with the best of intentions and treatment, we see that relapse rates are through the roof.
Yeah.
So we still have a problem.
And so if you had to sort of point at the one thing that improves that outcome, what would you say? Is it the kind of treatment or the duration of treatment or both?
Oh, man, I think it's both. Yeah. I mean, you know, first and foremost, I think that we have made a imagine this startling discovery, dual diagnosis.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, before it was, okay, you're an addict, you're an addict, you're an addict. Or, you know, if you have a mental illness, well, you go to a mental facility, a mental treatment facility. But we came to the startling discovery that they are joined at the hip. And, you know, the moment that we began to understand that we have to treat the patient as a whole, and that is, you know, not only looking at the comorbidities with psychiatric illness, but also looking at medical conditions.
Yeah.
Then we began to see better outcomes. So I think that, you know, the type of treatment that a patient receives makes all the difference in the world. Having said that, you know, going back to what you said about length of treatment, I think that length of treatment is key. Every bit of data that I've read indicates that, you know, the longer a person stays in a structure setting, the better the recovery rates are. So I think that it's both circumstances that make a difference. I mean, you know, in a perfect world, I would like to see a person at least 1 year in recovery.
I totally agree with you. I've always said that. I mean, what I tell them is up front when they come in the door, we're going to do this. We're at 6 months, because if you tell them a year, they freak out. And then at 6 months, yeah. You go, you see how much progress you made? We need to do another 6 months here. And a motivated person and a family that's engaged in treatment, you can often get people to participate. And yet, you know, the other thing that John Kelly out of Harvard has shown is that on average, it takes about 4 treatments before somebody gets 1 year of sobriety. And that data, I think, was based on shorter lengths of treatment.
No, I agree. I mean, it's interesting data. And what we do see, I mean, and from personal experience, I can tell you, I mean, I've had a number of patients that if I were to do percentages, mm-hmm. The great amount of patients would do poorly just with a few recovery treatments under their belts. I mean, let me give you an example. We have a patient, I still see this young lady, and she went through 42 treatment centers.
Wow.
42 recoveries. And it was not until she got pregnant and she decided that, hey, I really want to change my life around that happened. So, you know, how long is enough? It depends on the individual. She is, you know, I'm happy to report she's over 2 years sober now, has a little girl, and, you know, she's doing really well. She's working and life has turned around. But I mean, it took her 42 tries to get to that point.
It's amazing. And yet, you know, I know lots of people that have many, many treatments, and they value them all because they all got them to the point where they finally did get their sobriety.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the other thing that is interesting is looking at the motivation. You know, I have two types of patients. You know, there are the type of patients that come in because mom, dad, significant others send them there, or they're court mandated. And, you know, those are challenging to say the least because their heart is not in it.
Right.
And then you have the second subset of patients where they say, dude, you know what, I've done 2, 3, 4, 10 recovery attempts and I'm done. I want to be different. I want to change. I want to be able to have a life, a family, work.
Right.
And I think that those are the people that really can break through that barrier where, I mean, it's so difficult to get through.
Yeah, a patient of mine once said it very simply. I was giving a lecture, and this is a lady we'd had in treatment a couple of times, and all of a sudden she came in and started really working. And you can tell when people are working in recovery, you know, they're really doing their work and participating. And she asked me in the middle of the lecture, she goes, she just described her situation. She goes, you know, I came in here, I really didn't get it, I really didn't care, and all of a sudden I got it. And she goes, how do you give somebody get it? And I thought, wow, if I could figure that out, that would be the $50 million question.
Man, when you find it, I want it.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to spread it around because finding that shift, that moment of change, that willingness, that what we call capitulation, man, those are, you know when you got that, because those are workable patients.
Those are definitely workable patients. I mean, you know what? One of the questions that I love to ask my patients, you know, and it's not unusual to see a young lady or a young man, or, you know, doesn't matter their age, but they go to a program, they go out, they relapse, and then they come back, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And the question that I ask them all the time is like, okay, you know what, Susie, Johnny, whatever, what's going to be different? Do that, dude, what is going to be different? I mean, you know, I understand that it's difficult. I understand that you relapse, and I quite frankly, obviously, I care, but I tell them, I don't care about your relapse. What I care about is your mental attitude. And what did you learn from this relapse? And how is this going to change? How is this going to be different? And when you see that moment of clarity where they go, you know what? I'm just so sick and tired. I mean, it sounds cliche, but it is. I'm so sick and tired of being sick and tired. And when they mean it, you know that there is hope at the end. You know, there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and it's not the damn train coming.
Right. And are there any particular comorbidities you're seeing more than others? Bipolar disorder? Anxiety disorders, anything you sort of point at as more common than other things?
I think that we're seeing a tremendous amount of mood disorders.
Yeah.
And those would encompass anxiety disorders, major depression, and certainly bipolar. You know, we are getting a fair smattering of people that have schizoaffective disorder or, you know, quite frank, schizophrenia, you know, kind of like mm-hmm. the higher functioning schizophrenics. Mm-hmm. But you do see an enormous amount of depression and anxiety, which makes sense, you know, in lieu of the fact that these people have lost everything and, you know, their relational life is in shambles. So, you know, first we have to separate and tease out, you know, what is a situational depression and, you know, what needs medication management, and then what is really a genetically driven or biological major depression, which does indeed need medication management. You know, one of the biggest challenges, Drew, that I've been running into is that a lot of these kids get diagnosed poorly.
Yes.
So, for example, I have patients that come in and they go, hey, you know, Dr. Alba, they tell me that I'm schizophrenic, but I'm okay, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
And I go, well, okay, when did they diagnose you? And they said, well, I was high on meth.
Right. Of course, it's so much, so common for the meth psychosis to be diagnosed as schizophrenia. But, of course, the patients neglect to tell them they're taking meth. There's that piece, too.
No, that's exactly the case, you know. And then, of course, obviously, I have to adjust diagnosis. And, you know, I take the opportunity to kind of scold them. I go, dude, I mean, you know what? You got to be honest. I mean, did you tell the doctor that you were high at the time? No.
Yeah,
why not? Because
right.
I was embarrassed or I didn't want him to know or
didn't
what
want to
have
stop.
You. But, you know, we run into a tremendous amount of mood disorders.
How about PTSD and trauma?
That is very common to see as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, think about this for a second. You know, one of the biggest issues that we see, and whether you're male or female, is abuse, whether it be physical, whether it be emotional, whether it be sexual abuse, because you place yourself right smack in the middle of situations that are less than savory and certainly less than safe.
Yeah.
So I get a lot of these folks where they come in and they go, look, you know what? I don't know why. I have nightmares. I have an easy startle response. You know, I have night terrors. And, you know, I start digging in a little bit deeper and, you know, lo and behold, yeah, sure enough, they've been either sexually abused or beat up or, you know, something traumatic has happened. So
right.
Hence the diagnosis of PTSD, that's very, very common to see.
Yeah, emotional dysregulation is sort of the inciting thing so often, and adverse childhood experiences, people are finally catching up with that. Is there anything, you know, the meth-heroin combo has sort of become increasingly common, and that's so difficult to treat that combination. Are you doing anything special with that group?
You know, they're an interesting bunch, you know. And, of course, you know, they go by different names. Their favorite right now, I think, is kind of, you know, the speedball.
Yeah.
And my question to them is simple. It's like, okay, think about this analogy, dude. You know, I'm a car guy. I like cars. You know, so how would you feel if I took your car and then I stepped on the accelerator all the way down and then I slammed on the brakes at the same time?
Yeah.
That's what you're doing to your brain. You know, you're revving it up and then you're slowing it down. And, you know, why are you doing this? He goes, well, Doug, what goes up must come down.
Mm.
You know, which is kind of a perverse logic. What I don't get is when they use them at the same time. You know, and it's a tough one. You know, with the stimulants, I'm not too concerned about, you know, other than the physical symptoms. But I find that when you use opiates, the withdrawal symptoms tend to be a lot stronger. So, you know, oftentimes I will use a combination of, you know, a synthetic opiate like Suboxone or Subutex in addition to, you know, doing a secondary smaller taper of a benzo. And I actually kind of works pretty well for them.
Yeah, the meth heroin are so out of their mind. You know, the cops are always asking, why are these patients always taking their bikes apart? It's meth. Meth makes you dismantle things. And or as one colleague of mine dismantled his television to get at Conan O'Brien to have a talk with him about why he was speaking to him. And that's meth, man. The paranoias and the psychoses are so bizarre and so convoluted and sometimes so persistent and always focused on family, friends, coworkers, neighbors. Very difficult to deal with in relationships. And
No, it's extremely hard. You know, the other thing that kills me is, you know, we get a significant amount of young ladies, and they're pretty girls. And, you know, they get the infamous meth rash, which is an accumulation of meth under the skin, and, you know, they start scratching, and they develop ticks. You know, it's almost like a nervous tick.
Yeah, it's picker
syndrome.
They
keep scratching and scratching. They pick at their skin, and before you know it, they have scars that oftentimes will be with them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, Picker's syndrome. They believe there's glass or a bug or something in there. That's part of the – it's called formication from the word
– formication.
Ant. Yeah, they are as a delusion about something in their skin. But we're going to wrap this up. Dr. Alba, is there anything else you want people to know about True Recovery?
No, it's a great program. Look it up. You know, go to the website. And again, you know, it's truerecovery.com. You can always go to my website, which is pnsoc.com. Get more information. And as always, it's a pleasure talking to you.
You as well. Thank you for spending a little time with us. We appreciate it. Thanks for the good work of True Recovery.
Thank you. Take care of yourself.
Thank you so much, Dr. Alva. And we're going to return in just a minute with Dr. Ashley Winter, who is a urologist. We're going to get a totally different set of ideas going here and medical issues when we get to her. She also had a fellowship in sexual medicine and prosthetic urology. Very interesting woman. We're going to talk to Ashley in a minute. If you're like me, the list of books you want to read is just too long. It never ends. It gets longer every day. And you just don't have time. Well, Blinkist has solved this problem. For all your must-reads, and it's solved it once and for all, Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands of best-selling nonfiction books and distills them down to the most impactful elements so you can read or listen to them in under 15 minutes all on your phone. And with Blinkist, you can expand your knowledge, learn more in just 15 minutes than you can in almost any other way. Plus, you can listen anywhere. Of course, I love all the biographies, and I can't get to them. I listen to the Blinkist. The Blinkist library is massive. It includes timeless classics and even bestsellers like Fire and Fury. And right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Drew to start your free 7-day trial. That's right. It's Blinkist. I always am amazed we're able to do this, but you can do it for free just by entering the code Drew. So it's Blinkist.com/Drew, 7-day trial. And just think of some things you can get, like The Worry-Free Mind from Bill Wade or Emotional Agility, Susan David. There's just so much out there. Tools of Titans, Tim Ferriss. Get it all at Blinkist.com/Drew. Here's a shocking fact about probiotics. According to Naveen Jain, billionaire and founder of Viome, the at-home test kit that measures gut bacteria, almost no probiotics show up in people's gut analysis. That means that 99% of probiotics don't colonize the gut as they claim. And still, research shows we need good bacteria to fight the bad. So the solution is a single-strain probiotic with proteolytic elements like P3OM. P3OM uses a patented natural process to upgrade a well-researched probiotic strain. I use it. I think it's great. And it is a super strain that Wade Lightheart calls the Navy SEAL of probiotics. P3OM proved this strain is proteolytic, means it digests proteins, and eliminates the unwanted pathogens. It's maintainable in the human digestive system. And once in your body, the P3OM doubles about every 20 minutes and helps get rid of the bad bacteria before it is safely eliminated. So go to P3OM.com/Drew. That is P3OM.com/Drew. And watch it dissolve a piece of raw steak right there. And you can try P3OM risk-free today. They have the best guarantee you've ever seen, the best guarantee in the industry. It's a 365-day full money-back guarantee. So if you don't find P3OM the most potent, effective probiotic you've ever taken, their support team will give you all your money back, no questions asked. Again, amazing. I don't know how we do it, but you can do it. But you're going to be happy with this. I use it all the time. I use it every day. When you go to p3om.com/Drew, just be sure to enter that coupon Drew, and you'll receive a 20% discount. Check out our friends at Sunday Scaries, high-quality CBD. That's right. 10 milligrams of blend of broad-spectrum isolate CBD as well as vitamin B12 and D3. They're made with natural ingredients, free of gluten, dairy, yeast, eggs, soy, and peanuts. Sunday Scaries can be ordered from the website sundayscaries.com. They'll be shipped directly to your door. There are also subscription packages for recurring monthly orders at discounted rate. And right now, for our listeners, you can buy Sunday Scaries with a 10% discount and free shipping at Sunday Scaries. It's S-U-N-D-A-Y, the day of the week. Scaries, S-C-A-R-I-E-S.com. Use promo code Drew. That is sundayscaries.com. Promo code Drew for that 10% off and free shipping. Again, these gummies contain zero THC, so they are non-rewarding, non-high-inducing. They do not cause addiction, and people are having lots of anecdotal reports of really significant benefits. The clinical science has not yet caught up with it, but certainly young professionals, entrepreneurs, college students, they are all using this to great effect. And again, it is sundayscaries.com, promo code Drew, D-R-E-W. In my many activities, I've had unique opportunities to help audiences in different ways. Blue Emu has been trusted by Americans for over 15 years to support healthy muscles and joints. They now have produced an Amazon coupon made specifically for our audience, for you. Go to Amazon today. Use code 3DREW, that's number 3, D-R-E-W, for a $3 off coupon. It's simple. Go to Amazon, search for Blue Emu, B-L-U-E-E-M-U. Add to cart, apply the code. Again, the code is 3DREW. Blue Emu has a large portfolio of products, all American-made and of highest quality. Check out their deep penetrating formula of Blue Emu Original for soothing tired muscles and joints, Maximum Arthritis for arthritic pain, and Lidocaine for numbing pain relief. Blue Emu, not only does formulas work great, but there's no chill, no burn, no odor. Use this opportunity to support your muscles and joints. Don't forget, it is blueemu.com, promo code 3DREW. That is number 3, D-R-E-W. Time to celebrate. The Adam Carolla Show just hit the 10-year anniversary, and Adam is kicking it off in style. Join Adam this week as he welcomes late-night host Jimmy Kimmel on The Adam Carolla Show and Jay Leno on CarCast. Congratulations to Adam. Download The Adam Carolla Show and CarCast every week on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Endometriosis, it is an extremely problematic, painful problem, affects 1 in 10 women in America. This March is National Endometriosis Awareness Month. Endometriosis is a chronic disease, causes severe pain during and between periods, and sadly, women can suffer up to 6 to 10 years before being properly diagnosed, and up to one half of women with this disease will have difficulty getting pregnant. So talk to your doctor if you are suffering from recurrent pelvic pain. For more information, visit womeningovernment.org. Hey, welcome back. We have now with us Dr. Ashley Winter, the host of the Real Release podcast. You can find it Thursdays on iTunes. You can follow Dr. Winter at Ashley, A-S-H-L-E-Y-G, Winter, just like the season. Dr. Winter got her MD from the University of Medicine at New Jersey, currently works as a physician urologist at Kaiser Permanente in Portland. She did a fellowship in sexual and prosthetic urology at the San Diego Sexual Medicine and Kaiser Permanente in San Diego, as I choke on her. On your training, Ashley, and I saw you on Twitter, and I went, "This woman needs to be doing what she's doing," and I thank you
yes.
for it. Yeah,
thank you.
I know.
Can
it,
I?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, just as a quick interjection, it's the full release.
The full release,
in case people are looking for it. But thank you for
the real release here. The full release. Okay,
jumping straight to that. Thank you so much. Yeah.
No, because I've always felt very strongly that these. These topics, when they're addressed, need to be addressed by physicians. And
yes.
urology is the perfect training for it. And and a female urologist, so much the better. And I thought, wow, this is perfection. I got to talk to her. So talk to me about the podcast first.
Sure. So my boyfriend is a professional comedian and producer, writer. And we basically have a kind of amazing and wacky relationship, and you know, our friends and family would hang out with us and they're like, why don't you guys do a podcast or something? You know, this is just too good, right? How often do you have a female urologist who specializes in sexual dysfunction?
Yeah. And prosthetics.
And, can I say, in that vein, we actually had Dan Savage on our podcast, and he was over at my apartment, and I showed him a penile prosthesis, and he was like, what is this? You know, and it's amazing to me that even within the lexicon of people who are experts and fantastic, amazing, insightful people in the realm of sexual health and sexual, you know, well-being, that kind of certain aspects of the medical component of it really are still veiled from our common knowledge.
Well, no, because I felt very strongly about this for 30 years.
Yeah.
Most of the people talking about sexual health are not experts. You're an expert. You're more of an expert than I am, frankly. I have the mental health piece a little bit more than you do. But this requires a physician to properly address, and that's the piece everyone misses. Because these are common conditions. They are medical condition. They need a certain amount of experience and judgment to address properly. And they're axiomatic to you. And so and because you've seen a million of these, and you have the experience and the judgment to really sort of address these things. Hang on a second.
Yeah.
Gary, what are you saying here? He made me a little note on my screen.
I was just giving you the info. Oh. I thought you may recognize her boyfriend's name, and I was giving you a note that Ashley, correct me if I'm wrong. Did I hear you on Fighter and the Kid recently?
I was on Fighter and the Kid, yes.
Yeah.
That is
she's great, right?
She was amazing. Yeah. I put this together. This is who I was dealing with while I was booking her. But this is going
to
be great.
No, I know. And so I want you to kind of drive this a little bit. Let's talk about what things occupy you and make, you know, you're concerned about in terms of what the public doesn't know, does address, commonly addresses wrong, those sorts of issues.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think in the realm of sexual health, you know, big things to jump in, if we're going to move kind of in the direction of female sexual health, one of the big issues that I see, especially with the young women calling in, is the kind of underappreciated effect on sexual dysfunction of hormonal contraceptives. And
oh my God. Oh my God. Particularly progesterone, particularly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
and
the
physicians, I've spent 20 years of telling people your doctor is not telling you the side effects of these high potency progesterones. Forget the sexual dysfunction. How about depression? So depression and sexual dysfunction, exceedingly common from these. And by the way, there's a guy named, help me, Goldstein, Andrew Goldstein is his name.
There's an Andrew Goldstein and a Irwin Goldstein, and they're both really wonderful thought leaders in sexual dysfunction. And Irwin Goldstein, he was the actual first author on the New England Journal paper regarding Viagra, but he was my mentor during fellowship. But Andrew Goldstein is a gynecologist, and he does a ton of work.
Correct. And
with female sexual dysfunction.
I've got two podcasts with him. Gary's going to tell me the numbers. And Andrew is going to be able to tell us one day through a blood test who are the women likely to get sexual dysfunction and which amongst those women, once they get sexual dysfunction from these progesterone products, may not get better when the products are withdrawn. There's a subset that stay permanently down. Go ahead.
They are episodes 7, 39, and 12 from the good old days. You can go to podcastone.com/premium.
Go ahead, Ashley.
Okay. Yeah. Very good.
Yeah, go ahead.
He's brilliant. I've actually gone and just shadowed him, just hung out in his office.
Very cool.
And I actually even sent my mom to see him.
Well,
but, in terms of really iconic, I think, defining features of my generation is that I remember being, 14 or so, and, the general practitioner is saying, why don't you just start, birth control?
Yeah.
And at the time, I was so far from being sexually active, I was terrified of boys.
Sure, of course.
I was the kid that didn't go
destined
to prom,
for a career in penile prosthetics.
It makes no sense at all. But and I said, why? And they're like, your period won't be that strong, and you won't get any acne. Well, in part, why are you not getting acne? Because you're decreasing your bioavailable androgens. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that in retrospect. So,
that's your main source of libido.
Yeah, exactly. So we've kind of moved into this situation where we think that being kind of, pro-feminist, enabling reproductive control is to put everybody on something that actually suppresses their natural hormone levels before they've actually learned what their sexual desires are and kind of grown into themselves, right? And you can split the difference, right? You can empower people to control their reproductive health without
hormones.
Without hormones or, allowing that to kind of come into play later on or advising people more strongly on the effects. So I have spoken to women time and time again. It took them till they were trying to get pregnant. They stopped their oral contraceptives and they were like, oh my God, I was like horny for the first time and I was 33.
Yeah.
And I had no idea.
Right. And by the way, why are you not speaking to our peers? That's where I'm really concerned. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And this is not, this is really, evidence based. So if you look at what a combined oral contraceptive pill does, 100% of the time, it's going to raise sex hormone binding globulin, and therefore decrease the bioavailable testosterone.
Right.
So
I'm going to zero in some people because I'm used to talking about this stuff in ways people understand it. So it's sex hormone binding globulin is a protein that circulates in your blood that binds sex hormones, but it's what determines how much is available free in the blood, and that's the bioavailable product.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I will say on our podcast, we're super approachable in terms of the level of digesting and scribing.
I'm sure.
Yeah,
because you got your boyfriend there keeping you honest.
Right. Exactly. So that really is just amazing to me, and I think that is if I could get a word out from a standpoint of female sexual health, that would be the number one thing. And not to say it's bad. It's oral contraceptive pills are right for the right people. I think we've just kind of taken it too far and our education has been too little.
Well, let's come down on our peers. The physician peers don't spend time talking to their patients about side effects, or they may not even be aware. Really?
Right.
Not the way they should be. And when you said this, I wanted to give up and give you a slow clap because that's the first thing. I'm so happy to hear you championing that. That is a major, major issue. All right. What's your either next for women or what's your number one for men?
Let's see. I think for men, hormone stuff on both sides. So for men, I also think just the culture of testosterone is very, it's just not in a place I would like it to be, and in both directions. So on the one hand, the medical community, I think, has over-stigmatized testosterone use and to the point where...
In the setting of elderly, aging males or in across
exactly.
the lifespan? Yeah. So let me use myself as an example. You're going to do a brief assessment. I know this is unfair, but I'm going to make you do it anyway.
I love it.
I have essentially metabolic syndrome. I'm hypertensive, hypercholesterolemic. Everything's under control. No problem. Prostate cancer diagnosed age 50, Gleason 6, a large volume central lobe, weird, expanding under active surveillance over 2 years, had a radical prostatectomy. Okay. Got the whole details? Okay. My testosterone varies between 250 and 750. It's all over the place. I can tell most of the time I'm a little down relative to where I'd like to be. I do a lot of weightlifting and that kind of stuff, and I can just tell it's certainly not like it was when I was 25. What can be done, if anything, or are the risks too great given my prostate cancer history of replacement therapy of any type?
So in somebody who we say is no evidence of disease, right, as you presumptively are.
Well, my PSA, ultra-sensitive PSA, went from 0.0 for a couple years to 0.02.
Right.
0.02. Yeah. So that's essentially, active disease, right? It's like, I hope so.
Yeah. I would tell you that the consensus from most of the
I'm six years out prostatectomy, by the way.
Well, let me ask you, your science swings between 250 and 750. So when has it been 250 and when has it been 750? And
it's more up now. I'm on I've lost not a bunch of weight. I'm on a, carb-free diet. I'm eating a lot of animal products. I am working out, lifting a little more heavy weight. And when it's down, it's obviously I'm doing other things. I'm running more. I'm sleeping less. And that drives down my testosterone. And I think it was in more the first 3 years after prostatectomy, too. I think I was down.
It was down more, yeah. So in terms of safety, 100%, most people who are thought leaders in this would tell you, as long as you were informed of the risks that – and you are kind of an informed consumer of testosterone, and we monitor you, that it's not out of the question for you, right?
No, when I had my prostatectomy, I sat the surgeon down and I went, you're going to put me on testosterone in 5 years. That's my payoff for getting through all this. And now here we are 6 years out, and I'm like, I don't know. And how much would I take, and how would I take it?
Well, there's so many different formulations. The cheapest, of course, is to do intramuscular injection. I would tell you, if you're going top of the line, then the pellets are my favorite way of administration.
Bioidentical pellets.
Not bioidentical pellets, just pellets. I mean, the way to think about that, and that is something that does get to me, is the whole kind of bioidentical culture. So anything that's testosterone is by definition bioidentical.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
And so any FDA-approved formulation, right, there is a FDA-approved manufactured brand of testosterone pellets, is by definition bioidentical. But there's this situation where certain compounding pharmacies, and there are amazing compounding pharmacies. I work closely with them in my community. I love certain compounding pharmacies. But there are certain providers and suppliers who have kind of grabbed this bioidentical word to mean something that's confusing to the lay population. When you have something that's FDA approved or not, and it's same as what you have in the body, then it's bioidentical. So,
right. So just go for the best product, period.
Just go for the best product. Yeah. So I would tell you to get and I can't remember, it's called Testapel is the brand name. So I would tell you to get a Testapel pellet, you know, have everything monitored, have your PSA monitored, your testosterone levels, all your response, and go from there. If your levels truly are below the threshold of what we consider hypogonadal. So well, if you're not at 750.
They're not, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you're at 750, then you don't need it. That is the case. And I think
the reality is I'd probably hover around 500. That's probably the reality.
I wouldn't prescribe it for. Now, when I said I would give it to you, that was from the standpoint of prostate cancer risk.
Yes. Whether or not I'm appropriate case for it or not.
Yeah. And that's a good point of clarification. Yeah. I think that's another point to really hone in on is our understanding of the biology of testosterone in relationship to prostate cancer. So the misunderstanding of that relationship comes out of some of the essential treatments for what we call metastatic prostate cancer. And so prostate cancer that's spread outside of the prostate gland, no longer curable but treatable. And the treatment for that is what we call androgen deprivation therapy, or lowering the testosterone level. And that, you know, will cause the prostate cancer to regress. Now, if you don't have prostate cancer, having a normal level of testosterone doesn't cause prostate cancer.
Yeah.
And on top of that, having lower baseline testosterone levels is not protective against prostate cancer.
Right. I got to tell you, though, I'm working in the oncology field a lot through the Prostate Cancer Foundation. And, obviously, we're constantly focused on the biology of the prostate receptor and the downstream intracytoplasmic and genetic changes. It's a story that has yet to be fully worked out. It's
without
a very complicated story. But I get your point, and I'm aware of that. I'm aware of what you're describing, which is in and of itself, testosterone doesn't cause prostate cancer. It may cause, because we also don't know what causes prostate cancer that's metastatic to activate, right?
Right.
And there's possibility that the androgen receptor may figure into that. That's the little piece I worry about. So, and I know it's a very remote, it's not a common thing and it's not well documented as something that's a real risk, but I just worry about it. So, and given that my blood levels have been okay, I've been like, leave it be.
Right.
But I imagine, everything you're saying is you and I are on exactly the same page and all these things that drive us a little crazy. And the next thing that drives me crazy, so I'm gonna predict what the next thing that drives you crazy on, which is hormone replacement therapy for women and the lack of attention to testosterone in women after menopause. And so I was practicing actively when the Women's Health Initiative was published, and it made no sense. I knew there was something flawed in the data. It was just I read it and I was like, and the editorials were excruciating. If you don't follow what's in this World Health Initiative, you are as far off as a witch doctor because you're not doing evidence based medicine. You must take everybody off hormone replacement. It was a brutal time.
Yeah. So I was in med school, 2006 to 2010, and I remember in the class where they taught us essentially the definition of evidence-based medicine was reviewing the Women's Health Initiative.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's such a flawed study. It is so flawed.
And it's really – it's amazing because you are 100% in my brain when you went into that. So as somebody who does – not only sexual medicine, but just basic urology on the most basic level, right? I have all these women postmenopausal come in and they're getting urinary tract infections all the time, again and again and again and again.
Yep.
And they have a hormone deficiency in the urethral and vaginal area. And I say to them, okay, you have to use a vaginal estrogen preparation. You have to use it.
Right.
Now, there was a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine in the 90s, randomized, showing that in women after menopause, giving them a topical estrogen puts the vaginal flora back to normal, makes the pH back to normal, and decreases the rate of urinary tract infections, decreases your need for antibiotic exposure. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, we've shown that these medications don't even raise the blood hormone levels.
Right.
They don't lead to increased risk of any cancer at all.
Right.
And they don't lead to increased clots, blood clots.
Right.
So, and that's just a very minor specific thing, right? Postmenopausal women, older women.
Oh, and by the way, you're going to love this.
Yeah.
And because of these high potency progesterone, even in women in middle age, maybe even young adult, you see atrophic vaginitis. When they start complaining about irritation,
yeah. itching,
which is unheard of in a young person, which is exactly what you're describing in the medical, but that's from these hormonal contraceptives again.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Oh, it's amazing.
And they go, I've seen 20 doctors and they tell me I must have your current yeast infection, or I must have your interstitial cystitis, or I must have – they use all these jargon. Right? It's like, Jesus Christ, it's your progesterone. It's your product. And sometimes you take them off it. Sometimes you give them an estrogen cream, whatever. It takes it right away.
I have women who are coming to me who are, early 30s, late 20s, sexually active.
Yep.
Excruciating pain with sex.
Oh, no, I know what it is. And what they say is, I'm allergic to my husband, my boyfriend's semen. That's their common complaint. I'm allergic to the semen. Yep. A doctor tells me, or I'm allergic to latex, one or the other, which is neither. Yes. It's never that.
It is amazing. It is amazing how many young women I have given hormone replacement to, essentially, who have had 100% resolution of symptoms like that.
Yeah.
So easy to treat. And and again, have spent their life or their recent life feeling stigmatized and confused and told they were had crazy or had odd pain conditions for which none of the treatments worked.
Yeah.
And there was a very straightforward biological basis for what was going on. So, but yeah, on the other end of the spectrum, kind of getting back to the UTIs thing.
Menopause,
yeah. Right? So woman after menopause, having all these UTIs, I ask them to use the vaginal estrogen.
Yeah.
And on the label of the vaginal estrogen, which again, like we say, does not raise blood hormone levels, doesn't cause any cancers, etc. Yeah. The warning label from the Women's Health Initiative is on that medication.
Jesus.
And the leaders from American College of Gynecology, or ACOG, experts from that organization and the National Menopause Society have been asking the FDA to take those labels off for at least 7 years, and they haven't done it. And the patients won't use it unless you have very extensive counseling with them, because they're scared, and rightfully so, because it's a terrifying label that says you're going to get breast cancer and uterine cancer and blood clots and, and it's the hormone equivalent of using preparation H to some extent. I mean, it's not like the same as taking a high-dose IV prednisone where you're going to, so it's...
No, 100%. And so let's talk more about hormone replacement per se. I think it's being underdone. I think testosterone has been left off the menu to the great disservice to women. Where do you come in on that spectrum?
Oh, I love hormones, and I think more women need exposure to the appropriate level of hormones and testosterone. And there is, again, good literature supporting that. There's a Cochrane meta-analysis, right? So a study looking at many other studies on the effect of testosterone replacement in women after menopause.
And I'll just say that the Cochrane analysis is the highest quality of medical literature. There's just nothing better than a Cochrane meta-analysis. So go ahead.
Yeah, and it shows that appropriate dosing of testosterone in women after menopause can improve sexual desire.
Yeah.
That's shocking. There.
Shocking. Shocking.
And the ovaries make testosterone, and when they shut down, then that falls off.
That's your main source of testosterone, your ovaries. And it is the source of libido. The women are kind of an interesting mix. I mean, progesterone, estrogen, testosterone all have kind of different effects on a given individual.
Right.
But for the most part, testosterone is what gives you your sex drive, for sure. And to leave that off.
Sure.
And by the way, it stabilizes the estrogen replacement too. It helps with that. So do you put people on all three?
I will put people on, yes, I will put them on estradiol, testosterone, and progesterone. I put them on all three. And I will tell you, the women who I do that for are my happiest patients. They will come back to the office.
I will tell you my own wife, who doesn't mind me telling the story, was told she was depressed, this, that, and the other thing. She found her way to the replacement and was pissed. like, what do you mean I was depressed? I was just, this part of me was missing and I've got it back. And 10-15 years of goofing around, I could have been enjoying this.
Yeah. It's
vitality. It's a sense of vitality. It's a sense of, you know, sort of a part of yourself that's missing.
Yes. Yeah. It's total wellness. It's not just sexual health. Yeah. It's total wellness. Yeah. It is your genital health. It's prevention of infections. Yeah. It's energy. It's sleep quality. Yes. It's intimacy.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Bone health. Reduce osteoporosis risk. I mean, come on. People are so silly with this.
And the levels that you'll give people are not that much. It's really, really not that much to really cause a vast improvement in quality of life. So.
All right. So you and I are on exactly the same page on what's important out there. What were your myth-busting videos about?
Oh, those were old. I was in residency, so I did my residency in New York City at Cornell Hospital, and they filmed a show there, NY Med, which was produced by ABC.
I remember that.
Yeah, and so on the second season of that, they followed me around.
Nice. Got it.
And I ended up being one of the main people on that season. You know, and understandably so, right? I was the female urologist, and I'm 28, and it was crazy sex surgeries, they're like, oh, this is great TV.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful experience, super fun. But after that, I developed a relationship with ABC, and we did a bunch of little projects. So the Mythbusters was one of them, and we did a bunch of video shorts, things like, you know, in terms of heritability of male pattern baldness, and I forget a few other ones, but yeah, that was fun stuff.
Just curious what you considered myth busting. So it was mostly ABC considered myth busting, it sounds like.
Yes.
All right.
We do a lot of myth busting on the podcast though, I think. So yeah.
What's your main surgical practice now?
Well, I work in managed care, so it's mixed. My subspecialty within the group is definitely sexual health. So I do a lot of penile prosthesis surgery.
Implants.
Yes. So I do a lot of implants of inflatable penile implants.
Guys are happy with that? Men are happy with that when you restore that?
So happy with that.
Yeah.
I mean, the satisfaction rate is extraordinarily high. I think it's over 90%. Mm. Now you have to do the appropriate counseling, and my mentor in fellowship said you should never put a penile prosthesis in until you speak to somebody on at least three different occasions about it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the appropriate selected person, I think it's an absolutely wonderful option. You know, these are some people who they choose the surgery or they're not having a sex life,
right?
And not even that. I also had a mentor back in residency who said, it's not about whether or not you use it. It's about knowing that you could have the opportunity for intimacy if you wanted to.
Yeah, absolutely. I get it.
Yeah. And so I think it's a fantastic surgery. I think the technological advances with penile prostheses in the coming years will be very exciting. And I tell all my patients that hopefully the next time they get it replaced, it will be vibrating and have a remote control.
Wow. So, Gary just looked at me. Hey, I want one of those.
I know, right?
He's talking Terminator over here. It's
Terminator
crazy.
Penis. That's awesome.
Exactly.
But you're not doing kidney transplants.
No. And then I do a lot of Peyronie's surgery, so penile curvature surgery.
So let's talk about that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
In the past, people were kind of discouraged from that because of penile shortening. They would take off a piece on the opposite side from the plaque. And now there's also this injectable, I forget what they use, hyaluronic. What do they use to – there's an injectable.
Collagenase.
What is it? Collagenase, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that
so
work
So XiaFlex.
Well? Does that work?
It works. It absolutely works. It just doesn't make the penis straight on average. Mm-hmm. So if you look at, you know, the clinical trials and then kind of real world data on this, the average curvature improvement. So these are right for men who are coming in who have a curved erection.
Is acquired Peyronie's typically?
Acquired. The average age of onset is in the fifth and sixth decades of life. Hmm. So the average guy coming in is like 55 or
so. Is it from injuring, repetitive injury, or what do they get it from? Do we know?
No, there are a few things we know. So it is linked to Scandinavian descent, mm-hmm. and people who have a scar tissue in the hand or Dupuytren's contracture.
Oh,
so those people have a
thing. I didn't know yeah. that.
Yeah.
Gary, Corolla's got a risk for Peyronie's because he's got that Dupuytren's in his hand. Interesting. Uh-huh. Keep going.
He might have it, and he's not uh-huh. telling you.
Uh-huh.
You uh-huh. So, yeah, that's a pretty close relationship. And then it's a higher incidence in people who have inflammation in the body. So diabetics and smokers have a much higher risk.
Interesting.
Other than that, we hypothesize that it's from repetitive penile trauma.
Right.
But, you know, very honestly, nobody's taken 100 guys and made half of them get their penis, you know, hit for 20 years and the other
right.
not.
Right.
So we don't really know.
Right.
You know, but it is a tremendously devastating disease because you have people who have had a healthy sex life. They're 55 and then they woke up one day and it was 90 degree angle.
Yeah.
And they can't be intimate.
And it's
really fast.
Yeah, it hurts. Oh. It hurts the partners. But my understanding is the downward curvature is the most painful.
Downward curvature is certainly very painful. But you can have left, right. You could, you know, the most common is definitely up. You can have a corkscrew.
I know.
That is,
I know.
That is definitely something. But one of the interesting things I see about this is that up until about, you know, 20, 30 years ago, we thought Peyronie's was an extraordinarily rare disease.
Oh, no.
Now, yeah. with direct consumer advertising,
yeah.
we're normal, right, associated with these drugs.
Yeah.
We've made it something that you can now go and talk to your doctor about. And it turns out it's, as common as 1 in 12 men.
Yep. I'm not surprised.
Which is... Yeah.
What? How about the operation? Is it a shortening with that procedure? Have we gotten past that now?
So, like the injection treatments, none of the surgeries are perfect. Mm-hmm. And I do two types. So, I'll do either a plaque incision and grafting, mm-hmm. which is technically a non-shortening surgery where you basically cut out the scar tissue and you put in a patch either of their skin, so a dermal graft, or using a purchased pericardial graft.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, you'll basically put that down and sew around it
yeah.
and, you know, be done. Now, I also do the plication surgery, which, as you were alluding to, you basically just take the penis and kind of tension it in the direction opposite of the curve to straighten it out. And that does certainly lead to shortening. Now, the risk of erectile dysfunction associated with the shortening surgery is much less. It's much easier surgery to recover for, shorter pain, and less risk of neuropathy or nerve injury in the penis. So I will say to men, if you are comfortable with the length of your penis, then I still do recommend, if you're going a surgical route, to do the plication surgery. And I really find that when it comes to management of Peyronie's, choosing what is the best for a specific patient and expectation management is more important than one particular type of treatment.
Ashley, I'm running out of time. I could talk to you. We got to have another one. We got to have another meeting because...
Yeah, I would love to.
Yeah, because you're exactly... what I knew you were, and it's you that should be discussing these topics. If people are listening, Gary, you understand why I like Ashley to be discussing this stuff.
Yes, you and I discussed this the other.
Yeah.
I wish I could have put it together because when I heard her on that other podcast, I thought this is the young Dr. Drew. This is the next version. And then you described her that way, and I didn't put it together. But you were absolutely right.
Yeah.
I think she's great. We will have her back.
It drives me crazy to hear the people talking about sexual health. And all this we've discussed for the last 45 minutes gets completely left out of the conversation when more often than not, this is actually the issue.
I have a quick anecdote about that to leave off on. I went on a one-time-only date with a guy. Of course, I met on some app at one point. And I remember him saying to me that he read from some internet guru of some man with no qualifications that if he didn't masturbate for a month, he would have a higher testosterone level.
Oh.
And I was at the time in my fellowship studying sexual dysfunction. And he told me that like it was a fact I didn't know.
Yeah.
And I remember at that time thinking, physicians really have to push the public dialogue into better places.
Yes.
Because that was just so insane.
Yes. Your testosterone level actually starts to fall off when you don't masturbate, right? After a period of time.
No healthy adults need to spend a month not masturbating because someone on the internet told them to do that.
We'll leave with that quote. We'll put that as a headline of this particular episode. So people will appreciate it. But listen, I appreciate spending time with me. Let's put all your stuff out there. It's Ashley G. Winter on Twitter and Instagram. Podcast is the Full Release Podcast. Keep doing this. It's very important. Your Twitter posts are great. That's really how I came to know you. And just keep doing the do, because we need physicians in the media. There are tons of attorneys in the media, and very little of our peers climb into this because we feel like it's beneath us, or we're too busy, or whatever. But
or we're scared.
Yeah, I suppose there's a certain amount of fear in it. But if you do it, you'll quickly realize that it's nothing to be afraid of, and it's needed. It's needed. It's needed. So thank you for climbing in. And if I can be of help to you, you let me know, and we'll do another podcast somewhere down the line, okay?
I love it. Thank you for having me.
All right, Ashley Winter, Dr. Ashley Winter, thanks so much, and we'll see you all next time.
For calling times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's DRDREW Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the Swingin' Sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or DrDrew.com.